Welcome to Making Waves, independent voices for peace and justice. Your local connection to the world on WSCA LP 106.1 FM, Portsmouth Community Radio. This is Amy Antonucci, and I'm happy to introduce our show to you today, July 29th, 2006. Our focus today is on the 30-year anniversary of the first civil disobedience action against the Seabrook Nuclear Power Plant in New Hampshire. After our news, we'll bring you a series of interviews of Clamshell Alliance members with their thoughts and memories on their participation in the campaign to stop the Seabrook Station nuclear plant. Our second hour will include analysis of the current Israeli invasion of Lebanon, an update on the troops home fast against the U.S. war on Iraq, and music. We'll end with Between the Lines, independent radio out of Bridgeport, Connecticut. We'll also have announcements and more, so stay with us. First, for news you need to know. We start with an article from the Portsmouth Herald on July 24th. Rep calls U.S. Iraqi occupier. Congressman John P. Murtha's message was clear. Iraq's security situation cannot be solved by the U.S. military. Murtha, a Democrat from Pennsylvania, said during a press conference on Sunday in Hampton, New Hampshire, "The situation is getting worse, and the president has no plan to make it better. We've become occupiers." Murtha, who has served in the U.S. House of Representatives since 1974, was a guest speaker at the annual summer picnic sponsored by the Hampton Democratic Committee. During his speech, Murtha highlighted some of the mistakes he believes the president has made regarding the Iraq War. He said, "The president's current policy of staying the course has weakened our military and impeded our ability to respond to present and future threats. Our global diplomatic options are limited, and our international credibility has been severely undermined." Murtha also noted that the length of the war and number of troops committed to it is beginning to leave the military vulnerable. He said, "North Korea, Iran, China, Russia, and Al-Qaeda all want us in Iraq because they believe, as a nation, we are distracted. We are depleting our resources." Before serving as a congressman, Murtha was a U.S. Marine. From the UK Telegraph, filed on July 28th, "You're all targets," Israel tells Lebanese in South. "Everyone remaining in southern Lebanon will be regarded as a terrorist," Israel's justice minister said yesterday as the military prepared to employ huge firepower from the air in its campaign to crush Hezbollah. Haim Ramon issued the warning as the Israeli government decided against expanding ground operations after the death of 9 soldiers in fighting on Wednesday. Mr. Ramon said at a security cabinet meeting headed by Prime Minister Olmert, "What we should do in southern Lebanon is employ huge firepower before a ground force goes in. Everyone in southern Lebanon is a terrorist and is connected to Hezbollah. Our greatest advantage vis-à-vis Hezbollah is our firepower." Mr. Rahman's comments suggested that civilian casualties in Lebanon, which stand at about 600 after 16 days of bombardment, could rise yet higher. The government's unrelenting line has the backing of the Israeli media, which are demanding a harsh response to an ambush in the Hezbollah stronghold in which 8 soldiers died. From the Jerusalem Post on July 26, Rice applies no pressure in Jerusalem. U.S. Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice left Jerusalem Tuesday night without a ceasefire or a date of return. Israeli officials said that during her 2-hour meeting with Prime Minister Olmert, she did not level any pressure on Israel to end the offensive against Hezbollah. She also told Olmert that although difficult, it would be possible to put together an international force to move into southern Lebanon to help the Lebanese army implement UN Security Council Resolution 1559, including gaining control of southern Lebanon from Hezbollah. Diplomatic officials in Jerusalem said that Israel, which did not take part in the Rome Conference, wanted to see more energized international efforts to implement UN Security Council Resolution 1559. A senior official in the Prime Minister's office said that Israel did not want to take part in the discussions in Rome, largely because of a fear that it would come under a greater deal of pressure at the meeting to declare an immediate ceasefire. Rice repeated that the U.S. had no interest in returning the situation to the, quote, status quo in which extremists at any time can decide to take innocent life hostage again by using their missiles or using their capabilities, end quote. From CNN on July 26, Israeli airstrike hits UN observer post. An Israeli airstrike hit a UN post in southern Lebanon late Tuesday, killing at least two of the agency's observers, according to the UN interim force in Lebanon. Daniel Ayalon, Israel's ambassador to the U.S., said that, quote, UNIFIL obviously got caught in the middle, end quote, of a gunfight between Hezbollah guerrillas and Israeli troops. He said, we do not yet have confirmation what caused these deaths. It could be Israeli defense forces. It could be Hezbollah. UNIFIL said there had been at least 14 incidents of fire close to the post since Tuesday afternoon. UN Secretary General Kofi Annan said he was deeply distressed by the, quote, apparently deliberate, end quote, strike. In a statement, he said, this coordinated artillery and aerial attack on a long-established and clearly marked UN post occurred despite personal assurances given to me by Prime Minister Olmert that UN positions would be spared Israeli fire. Furthermore, General Pellegrini, the UN force commander in South Lebanon, had been in repeated contact with Israeli officers throughout the day on Tuesday, stressing the need to protect that particular UN position from attack. Ayalon called Annan's statement outrageous, while Israel's UN ambassador Dan Gillerman said he, too, was deeply distressed that Annan alleged that the strike was deliberate. The IDF said it was looking into the report. From the Interpress service on July 28th, Sunni-Shia split fades as Israel presses campaign. Hopes by the George W. Bush administration for the emergence of an implicit Sunni-Israel alliance against an Iranian-led Shia crescent have faded over the past week as Arab public opinion has become increasingly united by outrage over the Jewish state's continuing military campaign in Lebanon and Washington's refusal to stop it, according to Middle East experts. Fueled by television coverage of the destruction and suffering wrought by Israel's attacks, popular sentiment in both Shia and Sunni communities has moved strongly behind Shia Hezbollah, whose leader has become a symbol of resistance to Israeli and U.S. power. According to Graham Fuller, a former top Middle East analyst for the CIA and the RAND Corporation, resistance rises above sectarianism. Sunni masses, by and large, are not concerned whether Iran, Syria's rulers, or Hezbollah are Shiites. They applaud them for their steadfastness and willingness to fight and even die. The growing Sunni-Shia unity in support of Hezbollah defies hopes by Bush administration officials and their Israel-centered neoconservative supporters here that fears of an Iranian-led Shia axis stretching from Lebanon across Syria to the new Shia-dominated government in Iraq would provoke Sunni-led states to form a de facto alliance with Israel. Fuller wrote in an article for Global Viewpoint, the real split here is between the Sunni autocrats and their very own citizens. These Sunni regimes are terrified that Iran, Syria, Hezbollah, and even Sunni Hamas are all creating inspirational models of independent mass resistance against reigning U.S. and Israeli power in the region. That Sunni leaders now feel compelled to follow public opinion was made evident by several developments this past week, beginning with Egypt's rejection of Washington's proposal to hold Wednesday's Emergency International Conference on Lebanon at Sharm el-Sheikh. As a result, the conference, at which Rice found herself completely isolated in rejecting calls for an immediate ceasefire, was held in Rome instead. And our last news story, which we will follow with the beginning segment of our Seabrook Activism Retrospective, comes from the Portsmouth Herald on July 28, 2006. Nuclear plant faces $65,000 fine. The Nuclear Regulatory Commission has proposed a $65,000 fine against the owner of the Seabrook Station nuclear power plant for a violation related to security requirements at the plant. The company has 30 days from receipt of the notice to either pay the civil penalty or to protest it. In spring 2005, the NRC dispatched a special inspection team to Seabrook after a routine security inspection found issues at the site in May. Inspectors found that a security fence intended to prevent outside threats to Seabrook Station was inoperable, according to an internal plant document obtained by the Herald and reported at that time. According to the NRC, the issues were corrected immediately after they were discovered, and the nuclear plant remains secure. Alan Griffith, the spokesman for the Seabrook plant, said at the time, "At no time have we lost our ability to protect public health and safety." The fence was installed by a subcontracted engineering firm on October 29, 2004. There were indications that the fence had never operated as intended. The requirements to upgrade Seabrook Station's fence came from NRC mandates stemming from the September 11, 2001 terrorist attacks on New York and Washington, D.C. That's all our news today. Remember to join us for our second hour for analysis of recent events in Israel and Lebanon by Steve Diamond. Making Waves now brings you Seabrook Activism Retrospective, looking at the Clamshell Alliance and its campaign against the Seabrook nuclear power plant. On August 1, 1976, 18 people were arrested in a civil disobedience action against the proposed U.S. nuclear power site in Seabrook, New Hampshire. This event helped to inspire a growing and long-term campaign against Seabrook Station and nuclear power in general. We will be honoring this anniversary on our show this week. For this segment, we will be talking with Clamshell Alliance members to hear their strongest memories from the campaign. This show will also be the kickoff for 9 months of Clamshell Alliance member interviews. Between August 2006, with the 30-year anniversary of the first CD action at Seabrook, and April 2007, with the 30-year anniversary of the 1,414 arrests at the Seabrook Station site, we will run an interview every last Saturday of the month with a Clamshell Alliance member. Over these months, we hope to bring out the rich history of nonviolent direct action here in the seacoast of New Hampshire. We also aim to bring out current issues about nuclear power and its revival. For today's beginning program, we hear from Clamshell members Arnie Alpert, Macy Morse, and Doug Bogan. This is Amy Antonucci with Making Waves. For our Seabrook retrospective program, we're speaking with Arnie Alpert, now the New Hampshire coordinator for the AFSC, American Friends Service Committee, out of Concord. Welcome, Arnie. Why don't you start by telling us how you got involved with the Clamshell Alliance?
Well, I was a college student in Connecticut in the mid-70s. This was a period of time of the energy crisis, and I was studying environmental science and learning about energy, and this concluded that nuclear power was a bad idea, and I also was interested in nonviolence and heard about these demonstrations taking place at Seabrook, where nonviolent civil disobedience was being applied to the struggle to stop nuclear power, and I just said, that's where I've got to be. So I went to my first demonstration at Seabrook in October of 1976 and ended up deciding to organize my campus for the mass demonstration, which took place the following spring, April 30th and May 1st, where I was one of 1,415 people arrested at Seabrook, taken on a National Guard truck to the Concord National Guard Armory, where I spent 2 weeks incarcerated with a couple hundred good friends. That was my first trip to Concord. And then later on, I took a position working as a member of the office collective at the Clamshell Alliance office in Portsmouth, and moved to Portsmouth in November of 78 and worked there in the office for about a year, where my responsibilities had to do largely with development of educational resources such as the Clamshell Alliance newsletter.
So during all the time you spent with the campaign, could you share with us one of your strongest memories?
Well, one thing I'm thinking about that's significant is that, you know, of course, when this started, the people who were going and protesting and getting arrested were seen as pretty insignificant. I mean, before the No Nukes movement took off in the 70s, most people in this country thought nuclear power was a good idea, or if they thought about it at all, or just kind of took it for granted. We had been told it's the next big thing, it's technology, it's good. I mean, I remember being in eighth grade science class learning how a nuclear reactor works, and it wasn't like there was any question about was this a good thing or a bad thing. It was just, this is the thing. This is the future. This is technology. This is progress. So to change that equation required a mass movement of people, and that's what the Clamshell Alliance catalyzed with its demonstrations in 76 and 77. So that by 78, there were No Nukes groups all over the country. And by 1979, when the Three Mile Island reactor in Pennsylvania actually had a meltdown, something the nuclear industry had previously said could not even happen, and there it was, it happened, what we had been warning about. And all of a sudden, that drove it home for people. So I remember being in the Clamshell office at this time, and people from the mainstream media, you know, the TV networks, the big newspapers, the wire services are calling up and asking us for our opinion about Three Mile Island. And I remember getting interviewed, I believe it was by the UPI, United Press International, the rival wire service to the AP, doesn't really exist anymore, but ended up being having a quote from me counterposed with statements by Edward Teller, the father of the H-bomb, and a big booster of nuclear power. So it's like, here we have Edward Teller's comments about Three Mile Island, and here we have Arnie Alpert from the Clamshell Alliance. And in a sense, that's indicative of how we had been able to crack through the barrier of the mainstream media and of public consciousness through a mass nonviolent movement that was based on people power, not based on money power, not based on advertising, not based on lobbyists, but based on people all over the country taking a stand, and sometimes taking a stand which got them sent to jail.
What are some of the things that you learned working with the Clamshell Alliance, being a part of the Clamshell Alliance, that stuck with you, that influenced you, that you continue to use in your life, in your work now?
I think one of the things that I learned, and this really comes out of the nonviolent tradition as much as anything else, but certainly part of the style of the Clamshell was, well, in a sense, it was zany and anarchic, and, you know, drew from the kind of the yippie tradition as much as it drew from, you know, Martin Luther King or from Daniel Berrigan in terms of where it came from or from the labor movement, but that we were able to make a connection with ordinary people. We were able, even if we were getting hauled off to jail and some of us had long hair and ate granola or whatever, we were able to speak a language that people understood. We were able to make connections with people, and we didn't write people off. We never assumed that because of what somebody looked like, because of their class background, because of where they lived, because of their political party affiliation, that they would be or that they should be in favor of nuclear power. We didn't give up on anybody. We believe that every interaction with another person was an opportunity to talk about the issues and to try to communicate with them about what we believed was important.
Those seem like lessons that you must use a lot in your continuing organizing work for social justice issues.
And I think it's important, even if you have a message that is fundamentally radical, it's important for us to try to figure out how to relate that message to people who are not in the same place. I'm convinced, you know, that most people are against war. Most people would rather have their energy come from the sun than from a type of technology that is tied to the production of nuclear weapons. I believe that most people would rather see conflicts resolved peacefully rather than through guns and bombs. And if we can find a way to help people figure out how to use their own voices to make those things happen that most people are going to be willing to come along. And that's the challenge for organizers, is to make that happen, not to blame people for not being in the same place we are.
People who are now coming into activism, who are in the midst of an area filled with a tradition of nonviolent action, are there any words or memories or thoughts that you would want to put out there for them?
I mean, I think that each time and each period has to, in a sense, you know, invent or reinvent tactics and strategies. That reinventing the wheel is not necessarily a bad thing when it comes to how to bring about profound social change. But we can always learn from the movements that came before us. So the Clamshell Alliance drew directly from the traditions of the civil rights movement and the feminist movement, the awakening environmental movement, the labor movement, were all part of its story, just like the movement against the war in Vietnam drew from what had happened before. You know, it's not just like the 60s didn't just start on January 1st, 1960 and end December 31st, 1969. It drew from things that had happened earlier. So I think that the next generation of activists is going to be able to find a rich store of experiences and insights from learning about the No Nukes movement, just like it will learn from the African-American freedom struggle, or from the history of the labor movement, or from the women's movement, and all these other things. It was interesting. I was in Seattle in 1999 during the protest at the World Trade Organization, where you had these groups of mostly young radical activists in affinity groups locked down or blocked down or sitting down in front of the convention center where the World Trade Organization was going to meet. And in many ways, it was a totally new thing. It was revolutionary. It was exciting. It helped catalyze movement, certainly around this country. And in many ways, for me, it felt like I've done this. I've been here before. I could draw a direct line from Seabrook. Nonviolence training, affinity groups, consensual decision-making, blockading where something bad is taking place and risking getting arrested or getting clubbed or getting tear gassed, and see that same form coming out in Seattle. And in fact, the training manual that was being used by the WTO protest organizers in Seattle was the descendant of the training manuals that we had written for the demonstration at Seabrook. Part of me wanted to say, hey, you know, I'm one of the parents of this. And most of me said, you know, it doesn't really matter that much. Yes, it's nice to feel a connection to this. It's nice to feel like there's some things that we've learned and maybe some lessons we've learned, which might be good if people could learn them more easily without some of the pain that we went through. But it's also great to see the way these things live on through new social movements that get developed by the next generations.
Would you be willing to sing the song?
This is a great story. I mean, along with Governor Meldrum Thompson as the biggest booster of the Seabrook Nuke, he was closely allied with the publishers of the Manchester Union Leader, led by William Loeb, who wrote, you know, nasty front page editorials and attacked the Clamshell Alliance and others and, you know, anybody that he didn't like. It was more of a megalomania, I think, than a matter of ultra-conservatism. I think he was a bully, is what it amounted to. In the period of time leading up to a big demonstration at Seabrook in 1978, the Union Leader, for that matter Foster's too, were publishing these very inflammatory stories about all the horrible things that were going to happen, and how this demonstration was going to lead to violence and massive property destruction, and it was just going to totally disrupt the seacoast. And in the end, there were 18 or 20,000 people who marched onto the construction site for 2 days, had a big rally, an alternative energy fair, and then they all left and they picked up their trash when they left. And there was no riot. There was no blood. There might have been a little bit of sunstroke, sunburns, but it wasn't a disaster, and that made it a little hard for the Union Leader. They sure couldn't say, I told you so. So the next day on the front page of the Union Leader were three photographs. One was a photograph of somebody selling the Young Socialist magazine. One was a photo of some people sitting underneath a flag that said Gay Affinity Group. And the third was a photo of Dick Gregory, the African-American entertainer, speaking at the rally. And the caption said, The socialists were there. The sodomites were there. And so was Dick Gregory. And that inspired Dean Morgan from Manchester to write a song. And it went, oh, the socialistic kooks were there. Those guys are really numb. They don't like high electric rates. They hate plutonium. They don't want to get cancer. They all tell us it's a curse. But they don't realize that socialism's 10 times worse. Oh, the socialists were there, the sodomites were there, and so was Dick Gregory. There's nothing like the truth, it's so powerful, so couth, it's this newspaper's policy. Out of 20,000 people of diverse backgrounds and ways, there was one small group that had a banner stating they were gays. We can't show every group, so just this one we'll have to do. Besides, it was the one our staff was most attracted to. Oh, the socialists were there, the sodomites were there, and so was Dick Gregory. There's nothing like the truth, it's so powerful, so couth, it's this newspaper's policy. Oh, they had a black man up on stage, how un-American. Why can't they get white speakers like the Birchers and the Klan? This paper has a goal to bring to print unbiased views, for we will not stand for prejudice, nor for blacks or Jews. Oh, the socialists were there, the sodomites were there. Sing along, everybody. And so was Dick Gregory. There's nothing like the truth, it's so powerful, so couth, it's this newspaper's policy.
Thank you for talking with us and singing with us today, Arnie.
All right. Always great to be on Making Waves.
In our continuing exploration of the history of the fight against Seabrook Nuclear Power Plant, we next talk with Macy Morse, resident of Portsmouth, New Hampshire, and longtime activist. Thanks for coming to speak with us today, Macy. Why don't you start by telling us how you got involved with the campaign against the Seabrook Nuclear Power Plant?
At the time that the Seabrook Nuclear Power Station was being planned, I was living in Nashua, New Hampshire, was involved with an organization called Voice. It was volunteers organized in community education. We worked with low-income people. I was one of the members, and we were working on persuading PSNH, Public Service Company of New Hampshire, which was the supplier of electricity to people in the state, and with the PUC, the Public Utilities Commission, the State Regulatory Commission, to lower rates for people who use small amounts of electricity. In doing that, we learned that Public Service Company was going to build the nuclear power station. I also belong to an organization, an environmental organization in Nashua, and so we decided that we would focus on the nuclear power station. And we began to learn about the health issues that nuclear waste might engender and about financial and the environmental, those three points. At that time, Clamshell Alliance was being formed on the seacoast. So we sent representatives to their meetings and they'd come back and give a report, and they were organizing affinity groups to protest the building of the Seabrook Station. On August the 1st, 1976, I was headed for Maine with my youngest son, and there was going to be a demonstration, and 18 members of this Clamshell Alliance were going to walk down the tracks protesting the building and plant themselves on the property where the station was to be built. So my son and I stopped by to see what the action was, and I saw my friends, people I knew, walking down the tracks towards the site. And I thought, why am I not there? You know, I know enough about the health and the environment and so forth. But it was too late that day, and then I found out that these people had been organizing and having nonviolence training and consensus building. So then you just didn't jump into this and do it that same day. You prepared for it. So I came back and we started to form a small affinity group in Nashua. And then we came over to Seabrook. When the Clamshell gathered people together, they hoped for a larger number of people to take part in a demonstration on August 21st. And some of us from Nashua decided to join in that, and we formed an affinity group with some other people around the state because we weren't very large. And we did the nonviolence training, we did consensus building, and went to Hampton and camped out 180 of us. So on August 21st, we gathered and started walking down the tracks ourselves. When we got down there, we formed a circle, the 180 of us, and sat down on the ground like you would around a campfire and waited. We had a lot of supporters who were standing outside of the arrest area, and they had signs and were singing. Eventually, we were taken away and put in the paddy wagon and brought to the Portsmouth Armory. I didn't know where we were. It was a huge place, and I'd never been to the Portsmouth Armory before. But it was a very interesting experience. There are 180 people in this armory, and there are police and military around. They didn't know what to do either. We were trying to convince them if they were going to keep us, we were going to need to be fed. And also, if we were going to stay all night, we needed to have some cots or something. So the clamshellers that had been actively working already really had it together enough to negotiate with the authorities. And we eventually got fed from McDonald's, if I remember right. And of course, there were a number of vegetarians, and so they got lettuce and tomato and a bun. And the rest of us got a thin hamburger. And so that was our supper, our food for the whole day, practically, because I think it was morning when we were taken in. And we spent the night there. The one thing I remember about that was at one point I thought, everything is so quiet. And I think there are bees. It sounded like bees were droning. And I thought, oh, my word, I hope they don't come in this building. It was a big, vacant building, really. But the droning goes on, and pretty soon it builds, and then I realize that people around me are chanting, Om, Om, and it just went on and just got louder and louder and just enveloped that whole armory. And the police, of course, are not used to this kind of activity, and they were just beside themselves. They didn't know what to do. It really calmed everybody. And even them. So we spent the night there, and they brought in very uncomfortable cots. I remember, and there's no way you can have any privacy in an armory. Of course, a couple of years later, there were 1,400 people arrested at once. But our little group of 180 seemed very large. So that was my introduction to clamshell and protesting as a serious action.
So that was your first experience of civil disobedience and being arrested?
Yes, it was my very first experience ever.
And I know that it wasn't your last. Could you say a little bit about where either the CD experience or your experience in the Clamshell Alliance campaign in general led you?
Well, we learned more about how nuclear power plants are built and the waste and how dangerous that is to the health of our children, particularly. And I had several children, and I was beginning to have grandchildren, and I was concerned about the environment and the health of the children. And I didn't take part in any other activity like that until 79, when they brought in the pressure reactor. Again, 180 of us lay down across the road just off of I-95. Where the entrance to the Seabrook Nuclear Power Station is. We lay there, and I'd like to tell a little story about Nelia Sargent. The reactor came in on a barge or something down at Hampton Harbor. Nelia Sargent was a wonderfully active woman and had done a lot of social work and activist work, and she was blind. And Nelia always would engage her friends in helping her know what was going on and where it was going on, and you know, she'd figure out what she could do. Well, they got this reactor onto a big flatbed some way. I don't know how. It was just enormous. And Nelia got over with her cane and stuck it in one of the little grooves that turned the wheels, and she held that reactor up for over half an hour. They were afraid to break it I remember that incident as being remarkable. And we kept wondering. We were waiting at the gate, you know, laying across the road in the gate, and we laid there for over 45 minutes waiting for this thing to come. And here it was, Nelia holding it up all the time. So that was interesting. That was fun.
What a powerful statement.
It was. What little thing you can do that confronts the behemoth. Yeah. So you asked me about where this led me. Well, it wasn't very long before we realized that nuclear waste was being used for nuclear weapons, that could be converted to use for cruise missiles, the MX missile, Pershing 2, all of the different kinds of missiles. We made the connection between nuclear power and the waste from those plants and the nuclear weapons that were threatening the world. In 1979, President Carter had a mandate for first strike nuclear weapons. And then Reagan instituted that and made it part of the system that you could have a first strike nuclear weapon. And so we needed to learn about that. We needed to study it, and we did, and found out what that meant. And that led to my being involved in protesting at the Pentagon and a number of other activities that we took part in. Always we were writing letters. We were calling our congresspeople. We were writing to the president, doing all the things that we thought would make a difference. Our Congress is beholden to the people. We elect people to Congress so that they will carry out our wishes and things that we would like to have done. And Congress so seldom acts in the people's best interests unless the people themselves pressure them to act in that way. It becomes less and less that they're paying attention to us, but we still would do that. But when they don't pay attention, then eventually you commit civil disobedience. You protest locally, like we did in Al Haig's office, walked right in and brought a message for nuclear disarmament. And I worked in nuclear disarmament and have continued to do that. I do have one brief little story. I moved to Portsmouth, New Hampshire, and I was listening to the TV, and it announced that Seabrook was going online that day. I didn't know that. I think it was going online at noon. And so I thought, well, people must be gathering down there and I've got to go. I jumped in my car and drove down to the Seabrook gate and there was nobody there. It was about noon. I thought, well, I've got to do something. So I looked in the trunk of my car and I found a placard, and I had worn a black coat and I had an old big black hat that I put on my head. It was huge. And I made a sign. I had no idea what I was going to write. And it started to rain just about the time I'm going to do this. And I'm thinking, oh, well, I'm going to get soaked. But I took the sign and I wrote, "These raindrops are my tears." And I stood with that sign. And that's how I felt. I was sad that it was going online. But Clamshell did keep the nuclear station from going online for 14 years. And there was only one reactor went up when they had planned to put up two. So people were not polluted for 14 years and only half as much as they had planned on doing.
So it was not in vain.
No, I don't feel that it was in vain. It was something I had to do. And it's an example, too, for my children and my grandchildren.
Macy, thank you for speaking with us and sharing some of your remembrances about your work against nuclear power and beyond.
Oh, well, it's my privilege to be able to talk with you.
How many times will the people be damned? And just how many businessmen will ruin our land? And then how many times will the system hold reign? In a world with no future, the question remains. Till we rise up and take hold of our leaders and open their eyes and we put them to shame. Till we rise. rise up and take hold of our leaders and open their eyes, and we put them to shame. And how many votes will we give to the man who's the lesser of evils? The question still stands. And just how many people will die in the wake of a businessman's profits through nuclear waste? Till we rise up and we vote for nobody, if no one is all that we have to vote for. Till we rise up and we vote for nobody, if no one is all that we have to vote for.
That was We the People by Sir Barry of Glynn, from the compilation entitled For the Children. This is Amy Antonucci with Making Waves. Next, in our Seabrook Retrospective program, we're going to speak with Doug Bogan. Doug lives in Portsmouth and works for Clean Water Action. He's been active in the environmental movement for a number of decades now, and was a participant in the Clamshell Alliance towards the later years of the campaign. Thanks for talking with us, Doug, and why don't you start by telling us how you got involved?
Well, I had heard about the Clamshell Alliance, you know, back in the mid-70s when it made their big splash, of course. I was out in school in Colorado and was involved in nuclear issues out there. In fact, I got somewhat involved with one of those kind of spin-off groups, you know, the Sunflower Alliance, or one of the other alliances that started, of course, with Clamshell. So I was pretty aware of them before I even came to Portsmouth. But I got here in the mid-80s and found out more about what was going on, and yeah, I think it was around 87, 88, I got more involved and started volunteering with them and working toward a couple of big actions that we did around the time of their getting their final license. So there was, I think, two fairly large mass arrests back at that time, around 89, And I was involved in volunteer training, training people to do civil disobedience, and participated myself. And I guess it was the last big action where we had 500 or 600 people get arrested after climbing over the plant gates.
Can you say more about your role?
It was mainly in terms of training. Clamshell did have a pretty good program for organizing people and getting people involved in specific affinity groups. And I worked in particular with Guy Chichester and some others in the Seacoast area to organize a number of affinity groups locally. It was just a small part of the larger event. We actually did trainings the morning of the event out at the dog track. You know, that was kind of the staging area for many of our events. And then we'd all hike down to the plant gates. I was involved in a number of other later actions, efforts focused around the issue of the useless evacuation plan that they had put together for Seabrook. We actually did a burning of the evacuation calendars that they put out, which was a lot of fun. It brought out the local Seabrook Fire Department, you know, although we were being very careful to use a burn barrel and everything, but they had to come and put it out. So that was kind of exciting. And quite a few other events at the plant gates, just to draw attention, of course, keep the media attention up. So I started getting involved with a lot of media work at that time.
Can you tell us more about the evacuation plan and your work specifically around that issue?
Well, as anybody knows who's been out to Seabrook, it's in a really terrible location. I mean, for a lot of different reasons, but one of the key ones is that on any given summer weekend, you have 100,000, maybe 200,000 people out on Hampton Beach and neighboring beaches and all around the seacoast. And the idea of evacuating people out of there is just ridiculous. I mean, anybody who's been there, particularly trying to leave in the afternoon after a big beach day, knows that it takes hours and hours on a normal day. And you can imagine with the panic involved in an evacuation, it would just be total chaos. You know, you've got one highway heading out from the beach, and it would just take forever. So quite a few of us, and within Clamshell certainly, we wanted to highlight the issue of evacuations and the fact that it wouldn't work. And, you know, we'd point out how, you know, they had like Joe's Clam Shack was designated as a shelter for radiation. We're like, oh, do they have a lead roof or what? I mean, you know, it just seemed ridiculous. So we started coming up with kind of alternative evacuation projects. Some enterprising people, I don't recall their names now, but there was a couple that came up with, you know, I think it was evacuation plan number 23, where you'd attach a rocket pack onto your back and just shoot yourself out into space. And they actually came up with this skyrocket mock-up. It didn't have real propellant in it or anything, but it had a little fuse coming out the bottom, and you'd strap it on and hope that it would work. And we actually did an event out on Hampton Beach one day where we were all walking around wearing these rocket packs and radiation suits as well, just to get a little more attention and giving out information of, you know, no evacuation possible. And so that was kind of fun. It was a little tough walking around in a radiation suit on a hot summer day, but it definitely got media attention, and it was a lot of fun. You know, with a very serious message, of course. And to this day, they still don't have an adequate. In fact, it's even less adequate now, given that there are many more people living in the area. And certainly the risk of an accident is greater, partly because the plant's getting older, but of course, because of the potential for sabotage. It's really a scary prospect to think that they really don't have a clue what to do other than, you know, stick their finger up to the wind and try to figure out which way the radiation's blowing and tell everybody to get away. So we worked quite a bit and continued to, through Seacoast Anti-Pollution League in particular, to highlight that issue.
That's a great action on the beach.
It was so funny just walking up to people laying there in their bathing suits and like handing them this information. And they're like, huh, what? Yeah.
Are there any other memories or stories that have stuck with you that you think of when you think back?
Well, I think a great thing about Clamshell Alliance that, you know, frankly, a lot of other actions, other campaigns, other movements don't have so much is the community aspect to it, partly, of course, in terms of building affinity groups. But the music, we'd always get around and sing, you know, Acres of Clams or various songs, and you did feel much more like it was a family thing. And so I think, like in any campaign, you do get to know people pretty well. But, you know, there's certainly something special about the clamshell that it attracted people that were artistic kind of folks. And there was a lot of, not just music, but artwork, various very creative activities going on. And also to have a sense of humor, of course, which is very important. We all tend to get way too serious. And that was a good thing about clamshell that I remember.
Where did this work lead you?
Well, certainly I've had, at this point, pretty much a lifelong commitment to pointing out the problems of nuclear power and work toward alternative energy development. I continue to do that today with Clean Water Action. Despite our name, we're very involved in energy policy issues, particularly these days, and, of course, dealing with global warming and such. But, you know, I think just that whole experience of being involved with a very grassroots-based, organized effort that was challenging the power, you know, certainly in terms of doing civil disobedience, I think that was a powerful experience. To this day, many people do look back at clamshell as being the real forerunner of many other efforts over the years, whether it's nuclear weapons or other environmental issues. Clamshell really kind of got the ball rolling on that level.
I know that one group that has been active on Seabrook and related issues in this area is the Seacoast Anti-Pollution League, or SAPL, that started around the same time or possibly even earlier than the Clamshell Alliance. And I know that you're involved in that group. Can you give us an idea of some of what you're working on now?
SAPL has continued to be really the primary watchdog at this point, pretty much since Seabrook got up online. And, of course, has a long history, and you're right, going back to before the inception of the Clamshell Alliance, and continues to this day to keep an eye on events at Seabrook, as well as other issues in the Seacoast area. I served on their board for about 10 years now, and have been involved in efforts, and we've done some joint projects, too, particularly on the issue of lack of evacuation plan and also the issue of how to deal with the waste. There's still, of course, no plan for removing the waste from Seabrook, which really has to happen, especially what we're learning now about global warming and sea level rise. It's a particularly bad idea to leave your nuclear waste sitting on the shoreline that is rapidly eroding and disappearing and is going to be underwater in maybe 50 years or less, the way things are going. We work to point out the fact that there isn't a decent rail line going out of Seabrook. In fact, the one that exists has to go right through downtown Portsmouth, which should be of concern to people. So we worked to highlight that issue two or three years ago and continued to work on some of these other related issues and keeping the flame alive, I guess, on issues with Seabrook.
Well, thanks for talking with us, Doug, and thanks for your work on this issue.
Sure, glad to do it.
You can get all those people out. Me and my wife and kids barely getting by. Now they wanna jack my electric bill sky high. You'd have to be a crook to approve a plan like Seabrook. So come on now, people, let's make an honest stand and shoot down the evacuation plan. Come on now, people, let's make an honest stand and
evacuation plan.
That was John Carey with Evacuation Plan Blues. To wrap up this first segment of our Seabrook Activism Retrospective, we bring you Charlie King with Acres of Clams.
I have lived all my life in this country. I love every flower and tree. I expect to live here till I'm 90. It's the nukes that must go and not me. It's the nukes that must go and not me, my friends. The nukes that must go and not me. I expect to live here till I'm 90. It's the nukes that must go and not me. I've swallowed enough radiation. It's time I was standing my ground. So I'm joining that grand occupation. We're shutting that power plant down. We're shutting that power plant down, my friends. We're shutting that power plant down. I'm joining that grand occupation. We're shutting that power plant down. Seabrook, New Hampshire's a swell town. It's there that we're taking our stand. Why sit home and wait for a meltdown? Come fight for your freedom and land. Come fight for your freedom and land, my friends. Come fight for your freedom and land. Why sit home and wait for a meltdown? Come fight for your freedom and land. We are seizing this land with a vision, exposing the PSC shams. So let's sing of our happy condition, surrounded by acres of clams. Surrounded by acres of clams, my friends. Surrounded by acres of clams. So let's sing of our happy condition, Acres of Clams.
That was Charlie King with Acres of Clams. You've been listening to a Making Waves retrospective look at Seabrook anti-nuclear activism. Don't forget to join us for the last Saturday of every month for the next 9 months as we continue to explore the rich history of nonviolent direct action here in the seacoast of New Hampshire around nuclear power, and to bring out current issues around nuclear power and its revival. This is Making Waves.
To hear our previous shows, please visit our archive online at
www.freewebs.com/sprav/audio.htm. Please email nhmakingwaves@yahoo.com and let us know what you think of our show. And feel free to call the station in the next hour for more information, 430-9722.